Welcome to The Learning Curve with Roger and Virginia. The Learning Curve is about helping kids get good grades in school and succeeding in life. It's for all parents, teachers, and students, as all of life is a learning curve, and you succeed in life to the extent that you can learn easily. Today's guest is Dean Larson, the director of Access for Knowledge Learning Centers. Today's show is actually going to be quite entertaining. You'll hear Dean reveal the secret of how you can increase your child's test scores by releasing energy through the points on the, from various points on the head. It's called energy release points on the head. This is quite exciting. Dean can be reached at his organization at accessforknowledge.org. To get more information on the material we cover in our shows, you can go to howtolearneasily.com, or if you've got any questions you'd like to ask of Virginia and myself and get an email reply, you can question us at questions@howtolearneasily.com. So Dean, I've got a question of you. How are the Access for Knowledge Learning Centers different to, you know, the typical Center for Education or tutoring organizations?
When you walk into the door of an Access for Knowledge Center, you probably would find it difficult to see a difference. There's very little difference in terms of a teacher sits at a horseshoe-shaped table with three or four kids around and does the show. It's the show that's the difference. With a couple of minor things, Most of the tutoring centers and so on will do things like have a fairly substantial contract with parents and stuff like that. We chose not to. We chose to just, we'll bill people monthly instead of a large contract because we'd like to have people have control of their money. The big deal comes in what's going on between the parent and the student. I've had principals from area schools when I was at the full-time school that we had, come in and say, well, how are you different from us? And you walk around the school and classroom and say, there are the tables and there are the kids, and you can't see a difference. And it's all within that philosophical bent.
And it's the relationship with the teacher and the child that's so different from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, it's real common when we have a student come in for, let's say, remedial reading, it's very common for us to get a call from a parent 2 weeks into the thing and saying, I don't know what you're doing to my kid, but he stopped arguing with his dad. And, okay, that's usually a good indicator that the reading is going to improve. And it does. We have seen some really spectacular and unusual results with all this stuff. We've also seen kids that didn't do anything. There you go. But typically, it's not an expectation, but I would typically assume that you would see significant improvement. For example, it doesn't shock me to do for a child to pick up 3 years over a summer.
So I noticed, sorry, I interrupted you there?
No, that's fine.
I noticed on the site that you have seminars and teleclasses. How do they operate?
I do indeed. I'm right in the middle of one called Teaching Kids to Know That They Know, and I wish I'd have made a shorter title. We are right at the beginning. For the first two-thirds of that teleclass, it's an hour a week for 10 weeks. For the first maybe half or a little bit better, everything is geared toward the parent or the teacher, whoever the participant is, not about the kid. My dad was a therapist, and when I first got into the business, he said to me, Dean, a therapist works on himself, and his patients get better. And I said, huh? A therapist works on himself, and his patients get better. I have never seen that not to be true.
One of the jokes that folk often tell about psychologists and therapists, they get into it because they need it themselves.
Well, I used to train therapists. I wouldn't argue with that a bit. I'd agree with it.
I don't know whether we'd cover this or not, but as a specific example, how are the access tools used with kids?
There are many more tools than what we've talked about. one of the tools, and it's a hands-on tool, and it's not terribly handy in a classroom, although I've done it, is something called running the bars. And the bars are 32 points on the head where energy tends to collect. And they have names like money and control and creativity and so on and so forth. And so all of the considerations and the stresses and so on about money tend to accumulate just kind of in front of the ear, maybe up by the temple. And there's a little spot there that is definitely it. And if I simply put my finger on that, well, it's on both sides of the head, put my fingers on that, that energy will tend to run through me and out the top of my head, and everybody's happy. And it's about an hour-long thing, and we try to have parents learn that to do it with their kids. It's been proven to bring up test scores immeasurably. It also takes care of sleep problems and some attention problems. So that's one of the tools, and, you know, I've actually taught math class with my hands on a kid's head, but it, as I said, it's really cumbersome that way, so we would do that after class. During the class, one of the things that we will typically bring to a kid to eliminate judgment is teaching them how to look at everything as an interesting point of view. So, kid, if somebody says that you're stupid, that's just an interesting point of view. There's no energy attached. If everything is an interesting point of view, you'll go along on an even keel without all of this stuff, without all the trauma and drama knocking you around.
So you don't get into resisting and fighting it and opposing it and trying to avoid it. It's just so it's interesting.
It's an interesting point of view. If you get out of the interesting point of view, you're into polarity.
Mm.
Then I'm either agreeing and aligning with something which I'll have to defend, or I'm resisting and reacting to something which I also have to defend.
So in a way what you're saying is, yeah, that's your point of view, but I don't necessarily have to own it or agree with it. It just simply is what it is.
Right, and it's really easy if you think of it as interesting point of view, because I don't have to remember so much. Mm-hmm. I first came across it way prior to ASF when I was... One of the things that's true about, I deal primarily with chemically dependent people. That's true about chemically dependent people is they typically don't want to quit doing what they're doing. And so even when they're feeling guilty and awful about it, they really don't want to quit. So you're put in a position of selling something somebody doesn't want. And as you're just getting up to the point where the guy says, oh yeah, they will attack you. They will rip your lips off. So after having done that done therapy with people like that for 6 hours, and then I run a 2-hour group session, at 7 o'clock, when somebody in the group blindsides me and attacks me, it always used to score. It always used to hit me, and I just, oh man, that's just nasty. And so what I started doing is, before the group, I'd start envisioning as everybody had bow and arrow. And when they would shoot at me, they would shoot an arrow, and I would, in my mind's eye, watch the arrow miss.
Mm-hmm.
I'd push that arrow away from me, which is another way of doing an interesting point of view. It doesn't score. I don't have to react. I don't have to align. And the sadistic part of me kind of enjoys the reaction of the person that did it.
And you win.
Yeah.
But it's funny. The basis of addiction really is the positive intention to experience something considered to be pleasurable. And that's how it all begins. And then they want to continue it. So
that's how it begins. My dad would have said that alcohol is a solution for alcoholism. Alcoholism is a deep spiritual psychological pain I don't know what to do with, but I do know I feel good when I'm drinking. And you're going to take my drinking away from me.
Actually, I find it interesting in your write-up for the show that you have given us. I know we talk a lot about kids who are misdiagnosed or mislabeled and all that, but you also deal with gifted children. Can you talk about that?
Well, I can. I would have been considered a gifted kid. Just that's good enough background for that. And my experience in school was I was in the low reading classes. I graduated at exactly 50% of my class. And I was told by the college or by the high school counselor not to bother going to college because I was too stupid. And all of my standardized test scores were perfect scores. Anybody see a problem with that?
it's incongruous, to say the least.
Bit of a disconnect there.
I was absolutely convinced that he was right, because I couldn't answer people's questions. I looked at the world different than everybody. They would say things to me, and I would get all tongue-tied and stupid. I would dumb down my language to the point where I knew that I could be understood and people wouldn't react to me.
So in other words, your knowledge and detailed knowledge was so far beyond what other people would have been able to understand that when somebody asked you a question, you stood there thinking, how much detail do I give them?
Which question do I answer?
Yeah.
Right.
It's the same dilemma that your kid has when you say, go clean your room.
What
does
part of
mean
it?
Pick up my socks, or does it mean wash the windows?
Listening to you talk about your own condition, Dan, it seems that you are very holographic, three-dimensional in your envisioning, and that the world around you is like a big hologram.
I think, Roger, you hit it right on the nose.
Do you want to know something? That's a terrifically high level of ability. For example, it's an ability that dyslexic folk have, and it gives them difficulty trying to read two-dimensional writing on paper, for example. But the way they think and the way they use their minds and the way they operate in life is very different than your usual robotic dumbed-down sort of norm. And we actually write in our book that dyslexia is not correctly understood. It may well be the mark of a higher level of ability.
And you would have a lot of support from the Access people on that.
One of our guests a couple of weeks ago from 3DLearning.com, they call it right brain learning. They deal a lot with dyslexic children. And they've got phenomenal ability, these kids. There was an article in one of the big business magazines revealing the number of top creative CEO types who were dyslexic, inventors as well. Most people don't realize that Tesla, rather like you, you talk about creatively envisioning that they've got bows and arrows and the arrows are coming in and you deflect them as a mental practice. Tesla could actually construct mentally a vision around him of the technical equipment and make it work, and if he saw any imperfections, he could then reconstruct it and get it right, rather like the tale you gave about Henry Ford, then go and build the monster and have it work perfectly. These are phenomenal levels of ability which too often are not recognized in children that have them, and the kids are given problems because of it.
What I'm seeing with kids now, I'm also going to be doing a teleclass for teachers called Teaching with Ease. I'm going to do one for homeschool parents, patterned after that. But kids are changing. The traditional methods aren't working with them. And part of the change is what I've been calling the awareness thing, is kind of what you're describing. There won't be that dichotomy of really gifted, non-gifted kids. When a kid is really aware and knows that he's aware and knows how to use it, there's no such thing as genius. There just is, does stuff.
Yep.
And we won't be making those distinctions because we all have the ability. I'm going under the assumption that everybody has been given the gift of infinite beingness. Would an infinite being be stupid?
We both know the answer to that. They are certainly not. They're infinitely aware and infinitely knowing.
Right. And so if we tap into that,
or to use your words, access it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Which is why I find the what you call your practice so appropriate, actually. This is real value for our audience, by the way, Dean. I think they're getting a lot out of this, and it's going to be not only solving a lot of problems out there that have been effectively foisted on people, parents and children, but it gives them some real workable answers that they can use to make things go right around them.
Well, one of the reasons that I snapped this up so quickly and got to you is I'm not going to say that I'm on a mission. I think it's imperative that we start, however we know how, getting the kids and changing the scene. Houston Public Schools laid off 1,000 teachers. The ones that are left all are dying because they're afraid they're next.
Oh my God, the size of classes are going to be so overwhelming.
We yesterday had a recording with a fellow from the West Coast who's involved in homeschooling. In fact, it was his school and his organization that won the case in California in the Supreme Court to defend and therefore protect the rights of parents to educate their children at home. Fellow by name Terry Nevin, wonderful man. And it was interesting, he quoted a statistic of there's a, shall we say, a make-break point on the basis of numbers of students per teacher of where things begin to break down. In the modern educational system, I mean, I was in a class of 35 kids when I grew up. For some wonderful reason or other, teachers used to manage it in those days. But then again, if you misbehave, you've got 6 cuts of the cane, and that sort of corrected you.
That really does work. It has some consequences, but...
Boy, I mean, we had obedient children in those days. Nowadays,
yeah.
The monsters run riot. But anyway, I think it's 15 and a half, wasn't the figure?
15,
Virginia?
Yes.
15.
Yes, 15 to 1.
Above 15, the teachers lose control and the kids stop learning.
A teacher in the town that I was in, my school was in a town of only 12,000 people. So at the high school, he did a study of the amount of time per week that a student gets direct teacher contact. They get less than 2 minutes per week.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that just brings up to me, really makes an argument for a Montessori method of teaching, because then it's not directed. It's not teacher-directed, it's student-directed. You don't need to have somebody sitting there in front of the classroom, being the font of all knowledge. The student learns how to learn for themselves.
Well, and I go back to the education system, so I call Ed the education monster, the normalizing of education and making it so that my school has to be a factory and I have to operate as the machine that punches out the kids.
Now, that couple of minutes that you mentioned of direct contact, that's actually when the student can actually directly talk to the teacher. And get an answer and get some help. The other figure that was given to us over the weekend was that, was it on a weekly basis? No, it was in a 6-hour day
right.
of school attendance, the kids actually are only in class
learning.
Doing some learning for just under 90 minutes. Talk about amount of wasted time.
The school that we have in Fergus Falls is open 4 days a week, and the school day is 4 hours long. And the students sit at a U-shaped table with a teacher, and everybody has their own curriculum at their own pace, and it's amazing what you can learn.
When the time is being applied correctly on subjects of interest to the child,
yes.
with a facilitating adult present to help them through it. So here's a question for you, Dean. How could this method that you've got available for parents be used by them when working with the kids that go to school, the regular school?
The purpose for the teleclass that I'm doing right now, the teaching kids to know that they know, is designed to help parents work with kids. One of the first things a parent can do is to become an allowance of the kids, the same way I'm asking teacher to do.
Okay.
So that I am neither judging as good or bad what's going on with the kid, I'm simply being an allowance.
Okay.
And I can open up a space. Once I've gotten rid of the judgment, I can open up a space there, and the two of us can share a space, and then we can get down to what's happening. Then I can start asking questions, like, what are the possibilities for this, or whatever, or just a conversation. So you're looking kind of rough, what's going on? And listen. Shut up and listen and get the clues, and then we can talk about what are the possibilities for making it so that you don't want to strangle your teacher.
Plus, also, I imagine the parent does not have the idea that the child is wrong. They have, what is it, how did you put it before? It's an interesting point of view. There are no judgments, as you said.
There are no judgments. And in fact, one of the big struggles in working with kids is kids... just about all of them have a rock-bottom belief of the wrongness of them.
Really?
So they're walking around saying, what's wrong with me that it's going on like this, even though they're blaming the teacher and so on. So we spend a lot of time working on what's the rightness.
That's important, yeah.
So when I'm talking to the parent and I'm saying, okay, let's open up a space here, son, what's right about this situation? What do we not have to worry about fixing? And sometimes that's all it takes.
So the focus is actually on the ability and realizing the ability and applying the ability, rather than considering you've got the problems with and getting stuck with can'ts and inabilities.
Absolutely. Another thing that pops up often as problems, if you go and ask the teacher, okay, what's really going on with my kid, invariably you will get some variation of he's not following the rules. He doesn't hand his homework in on time, or he doesn't stand in line, or he doesn't listen, or he's not following the rules. What happens if the kid thinks the rules are bogus? He's got awareness coming out his ears, and he thinks the rules are bogus, so he just decides not to do them.
You spoke to my problem there, Dan. That was me 60 years ago.
You're out of your flipping mind. Why am I standing in line? It's a nice day. I could be out on the playground.
My teacher screwed up on me a little bit now. I ended up saying, this is no fun. I'm out of here. And I could hardly wait till I got out of the place.
Shoot.
So anyway, I just want to make one comment, and that is when you were talking about parents, what they can do to look for what is right about the situation, what is good, what is right about the situation. That actually is one of the exercises we have in our book. Is we call it, I think it's rehabilitation of learning or something.
Certainty
like
of
certainty
ability,
of learning. That's
certainty
it.
Of the ability to learn. Yeah.
Right. We have the student look at what do you know how to do. Don't look at what you don't know how to do, but what do you know how to do?
Recall a time when you did learn something that, you know, you wanted to learn.
And I've actually used this on some of my tutoring students, maybe not as overtly, but very covertly perhaps, by asking them, well, what do you know? Show me what you can do.
I found with kids that you can be absolutely upfront, brazen, and honest. Doesn't matter who, you can be in their face and say, hey, look, and tell them, we need to find out what you've actually done here, and okay, it's remarkable. It's fantastic. Every kid and adult, because I've also tutored adults, has given me a gift. Every one of them. Yes. They're just remarkable.
Now, I noticed a little line here in some of your written material, Dean, which I like, and it's on the subject of learning, and it says, now that I know what I know, what do I do with it?
Oh, yeah. So we take you through a course, and we teach. I teach a speed reading course. I'll have people for about 3 hours, and the first thing I do is have them read as fast as they can to get as tense as they possibly can, because we all know the harder you work, the better you read. Wrong. And then I start jumping the times up on them, so that if you were reading this much in a minute and a half, we're going to do it in 45 seconds. We're going to do it in 30 seconds and 20 seconds. And I test them after every reading. And a really interesting thing, I did this with a mixed class of adults. 3 of the adults in the class were non-English speakers, and we were using English language books. And I simply opened the pages and closed them. Open, close. And I tested them. The lowest score in the class was 80%. Because they could tap their knowledge. One of the things that's absolutely true is if you can see the page, it's in your head. Okay, so the problem isn't getting the information in, the problem is getting the information out. So what happens if we make it, and it was a really interesting experience. Remember in the old days they used to do those trust experiments where you'd fall over backwards and people would catch you and that kind of stuff?
Hopefully they'd catch you, yes.
Yeah, I had some friends that loved me. Anyway. When you're doing this reading exercise, this knowing that you know exercise, there's the same feeling of insecurity and lack of trust that has to be overcome before you'll allow yourself to know that you know. And that's the bogus part, or the bugaboo part, I guess. You go after that, you get that taken care of, and there's some teaching tricks that go with that. I let students borrow my magic, if you would. And, oh, yeah, well, he's telling me what to do, so it's working. You know, it's kind of like Dumbo the elephant and the feather. Okay, I let them all have a feather, and they can do it, and then I take the feather away, and they can still do it. It's fun.
The subject of kids who are really troubled, those that really do have conditions such as attention deficit disorder or ADHD and all the rest of it, do you have any successes in handling those kind of situations, Dean?
I only wrote down diagnoses that we've actually done and had success with. I didn't include Tourette's, but I had that in there too. And we did pretty much the same things. But what is required is for a teacher to be aware of. We had two seventh grade twins who were autistic, anxious. Oh man, these kids, it just about made your teeth hurt when they start the anxieties. But what was required of the teacher was to be an allowance, but also to be an awareness. I'm aware of the fact that these kids' skin is more sensitive than other people's. I am aware that these kids are processing 1,000 times the information that the other kids in the room are processing. I'm aware that they're psychic. When I have those awarenesses, I know how to behave. When I know how to behave, I can then say, okay, so we got that down. Now let's talk about some adaptive responses that you can have to a world full of crazy people who aren't like you.
Who are bombarding you with their thoughts.
Well, how can you make it so that you aren't in pain when you're in a room full of people? We never did that directly, like a therapy session. Always done while I was keeping their thinking mind busy doing math. And you just do it quietly, energetically, whatever, and they respond. They are so grateful for the relief that they respond right away.
That's fantastic. Sure as hell beats the pants off having to drug them.
I'm not a big fan of that.
No, me neither. We have a young lady we're working with now who was massively misdiagnosed and was given all kinds of drugs for all sorts of things she didn't have. You know the drill. It almost ruined her life. We'll have her on the program and probably next month. It's the sort of thing that parents really need to be made aware of, to just don't blindly accept conventional wisdom. Seek out some fellows like you who've got some alternative, more workable, kinder, gentler answers. Dean, it's been a delight being with you today, my friend.
I have enjoyed you both.
Well, it's been a revelation, actually. I thought I knew my game, but this has been an eye-opener, and I know our audience will have gotten an immense amount out of it. We'll do it again in the future, my friend.
Oh, I hope so.
And thanks for being here.
Well, thank you both.
You can reach Dean Larson at Access for Knowledge Learning Centers. The web address is accessforknowledge.org. For Roger and Virginia at The Learning Curve, you can ask questions of us by going to questions@howtolearneasily.com. Next week's guest is Murray Bass. Murray is the founder and president of Tools of Learning for Children. Murray is a rather delightful old campaigner at 83 years old, and you'll hear how his organization is setting up kids for school. His website is toolsforpreschool.org, and the success they are having is quite phenomenal. You folk with young children really do need to hear this show, because he will reveal how they are having 3- and 4-year-olds actually being able to read books. So one of the key questions that Murray answers is, when do you start with your children? How do you offer it? Make fundamental skills a top priority. This is going to be an exciting show next week, so we'll see you next week on The Learning Curve with Roger and Virginia.